And hello, everyone out there in podcast and NPR land, and welcome back to the Front Row Podcast, the podcast for people who actually like movies. And we are just flooding your podcast waves here with Oscar spotlights because it's the Oscar season. And we are going to be doing another one for you here today, the one that's probably taking home some awards. I'm Jeremy Gechner, the editor-in-chief here with me on the first Oscar spotlight she's on.
No.
The second Oscar spotlight that she's on for this this go-around. My wife, Sarah Baltusevich Gechner.
Thanks for noticing me.
You're very welcome. Well, it's just because I'm intimidated because we've got film historian extraordinaire Brandon Davis, the host of Classics, with us today.
Wow. Oh, man. I can't live up to these introductions.
I never can either.
Now both of you need to raise the game.
Sorry,
here.
Bud.
Well, luckily though, we're talking about a topic that you two have way too much knowledge about. We are going to be breaking down the Oscar nominated film Judy here for this edition of the Oscar Spotlight. A great movie here starring Renee Zellweger, a resurgent career performance here for her. She's racking up the awards on the pre-circuit here. But you know, this is one of those movies that it looks like it's going to be taking up some gold, but let's just go real quick. Just some overall impressions of the movie. Sarah, you are such a huge Judy Garland fan for so long. What you studied her reports and stuff.
like in seventh grade.
Yes. Okay. No, this was like last week. I'm telling you, everyone. No, but what did you think overall of the movie Judy when you saw it?
It's a really interesting take on her life, as far as they only really focus on the last like year, not even the very end, but just her London concerts that she was doing in the last year of her career.
When she was already pretty down and
out. Which is kind of, a tragic, you know, we've already reached kind of the depths of her career at this point. But I think I made a comparison when we were watching it to the movie Jackie that came out a couple years ago.
This was a very apt observation. Brandon, see what you think.
The way I felt about it was the same way I felt about that movie, where Natalie Portman was wonderful in her portrayal. And while it did carry the movie, I just didn't think the movie as a whole wasn't amazing to me. But because Zellweger really, really portrays Judy Garland extremely well, I think the movie succeeds in what it's trying to do.
Yeah.
But it's definitely carried by that performance. So where I don't think the movie itself is deserving of a Best Picture or anything like that, I think her performance is completely noteworthy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of like a sense of the film itself doesn't have like the awesome merits, but the performance is so good that, and because the film is the performance, it kind of by default is good. Like that's kind of what you're saying.
Right.
Brandon, what do you think of that? And what were your thoughts on Judy when you saw it?
Yeah, actually I didn't think about Jackie, but that's a good comparison because I think they're both cases where the parts are better than the whole. And I don't think that in either one of those movies, I don't think the scripts live up to how good the lead performances are. So I think, you know, Renee Zellweger deservedly, I think she is phenomenal. And I think that she really, you know, transformed herself amazingly well. I kind of felt after the movie was over, I'm like, man, if you didn't know too much about Judy Garland or about just Hollywood lore, I think you'd be a little lost.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I feel like it's the last part of a mini series where no one has seen the first 10 episodes.
It is. Like, I have like a really strong connection to the Judy Davis one, the Judy Garland, Me and My Shadows. It is. It's like watching the last hour of that.
Yeah.
Because if you didn't know her life story, you'd be like, wait, what?
You're absolutely right. Brandon, keep going.
No, and with the Judy Davis one, you know, you're able to go through her whole life and you get to see the triumphs as well as the tragedies.
Yes.
And this is just tragedy from beginning
Straight
to
up
end.
Tragedy for a good 2 hours.
Cringeworthy,
almost.
This and Joker would make a great nihilistic double feature in this Oscars.
Really, though?
It's weird because, you know, I have the same thoughts of you guys, is that, you know, the performance is clearly amazing, but the movie itself is pretty uneven. But the, you know, it's not just like you know, we just wallow with Judy in this movie. You know, there's moments of great joy, especially the, you know, impromptu late night dinner party she has with the gay couple there in London. Like that's like really, really fun. Just kind of reminding you of how much charm and how much joy Judy could affect even at some of her lowest moments.
I just like wonder like what, why the choice to just choose that section of her life.
Right.
I mean, of all, I mean, I don't know, just like the, just this, couple of month period where she's doing these concerts in London and her life is just kind of in the bag at this point. Like, I don't know. It's just a very odd choice to put it there, to start it there.
I saw an interview that Lorna Luft did back around the time the movie came out, and she was in England promoting something, and they were asking her about this movie, and she bluntly said that she wasn't going to see it. And she said that her issue is always the media always tries to present her mom as such a tragic figure. And she said, she said, us as her kids have always tried to balance that out and say, okay, she had tragedies in her life, but she herself was not tragic. And that she said, that's the issue that they've always had. And she said, I feel like I have to protect her legacy in that way.
Yeah. I think I read something where Liza wasn't happy at all with this film.
I could totally see that because it's definitely the whole film kind of exists to get to not only show Judy at her lowest points, but then through the use of like the Lost style flashbacks, like show us why she's such a tragic character as well. So it's like, here's the tragedy and here's why the tragedy, here's a few bright spots.
And I almost wish, I mean, I wish the flashbacks would have spanned like a longer period. Like all the flashbacks stem from one section of her, like I wish the flashbacks would have gone through different eras of her life, you know, different, because we see a young kid and we see a pretty much washed up old lady by the end. We're missing all of the good meat in the middle of her career.
And part of the criticism I think is the timeline of the flashbacks don't necessarily add up, because according to all, you know, research and everything, Oz was a pretty happy experience, and none of the, you know, more gruesome things that happened to her
until a little bit later. Oz was so early in her career that it wasn't.
And I definitely want to go wholesale into Louis B. Mayer and how terrible of a person. Look, the timeline might not have been right, but by all reports, this was pretty accurate to have
he
treated her and such. And, you know, I definitely think that. The movie as a whole, though, it's like, and I think that, you know, with the way they choose to portray her in this, it's like, you're right. It's like they're trying to find the sunshine amidst like those little rays of sunshine amidst the clouds. You know, kind of the come on, get happy type of, state of mind with this movie. And again, there are moments of that, like her, you know, like Zellweger plays up like kind of the inherent uncertainty of what she has left in the tank, you know, when she starts this tour. And she really kind of plays that quiet desperation yet firm, you know, bravado that Judy always had as well, like at the beginning when they're kicked out of the hotel. And, you know, there's a lot of people might think that this is just a standard impression, but like there's a lot of great, you know, acting work going into this performance here. I mean, what do you guys think about, you know, Zellweger as a whole in this movie?
Oh, she's, I mean, undeniable.
Like what specifically, I guess, is what I'm asking. You know, like what connected with you guys knowing how big of a Judy Garland fans you are?
I mean, obviously the fact that she does her own singing.
Yeah, that's a plus.
That's a huge deal right there.
She didn't win for Chicago anyway.
I know, but last year, Rami Malek won, right?
Yeah.
And so it's playing another icon, but you know, his singing was overlapped with so many other things. So the fact that this is all her,
right?
I mean, that of course, I mean, yeah, it's obvious, but it's extremely impressive.
Yeah. But that's obviously something that, you know, some critics have dinged for is that, you know, like it, in terms of, you know, does she sound enough like Judy Garland? But I think it's a plus personally that she's using her voice and her impression of Judy's voice.
There were moments where it was perfect. Mm-hmm. There were moments where I was like, there were moments where the power wasn't there.
Right.
Which, you know, it was probably accurate in some ways because it was towards the end of her career, but she, I don't know. There were moments when it was just like, okay, that's not quite on point with how it would have sounded and how she sounded, because I used to, like, I was a big nerd in seventh grade, and I had, like, all these Judy Garland show CDs that I listened to that my mom bought me for my birthday one year because I wanted them. But, yeah, I mean, I still think it's pretty impressive that she does her own singing, whether or not it points at misses the mark. But, I mean, geez, who else can do that, you know?
Yeah, well, and the thing that's on her side, I think, with this is that she's playing Judy at a point where she wasn't at peak voice. So it's okay if it doesn't sound quite as right.
Right.
And I think I even saw in an interview where, you know, Zellweger said that was kind of the thing where she thought, okay, I can do this because I'm not aiming for peak Judy Garland here. Like,
the big sound. There are moments. I just remember, I said that to Jeremy when we were watching, and I was like, some of those notes that were, I was like, I wonder if that was intentional, you know, because there's those moments in where, she was not even close to her peak vocal prowess at that point. But even
watching, you know, Renee has said many times that she basically just lived and breathed on Judy Garland YouTube videos prepping for this. And you can she's got those very manic mannerisms that she had later in her life down pat.
Absolutely. And the facial expressions, because Jeremy brought this up, you know, Renee Zellweger is a very kind of squinty eyed person. She doesn't have she always kind of has her eyes are always seem half closed, but I mean, she had the wide eyed Judy Garland look nailed the whole time, which is extremely impressive. Those facial expressions that she brought to, especially the stage, but the whole performance as a whole too.
Absolutely. And the vocal patterns that she does, you know, when you watch her in later interviews later in her life, she had that very sort of specific way of speaking and that wit about her. And she really sort of, I think she got that down pat. But it doesn't feel like an impression to me though, which is good.
No, I agree.
Cause sometimes, you know, in some of these biopics, I'm like, oh, they're just doing like a Las Vegas comedian impression of somebody, but she's really, there's truth in everything that she's doing.
Yeah, she definitely embodies her. You're right. It doesn't feel at all like she's just emulating her. There are moments where you look at her and you forget that it's not her, because I remember, like, right when we started watching it, I was like, I need to see what I pulled up a picture of her just to, so I could, you know, envision it. And cause I honestly, like I said, I'm very tied to that Judy Davis one because I think it's really well done. Even though it wasn't like a big budget one, but she, cause I thought Judy Davis looked, I mean, exactly
she
like
did.
Her creepily. So creepily. So,
and you know, so, Tammy Blanchard wasn't a bad,
no, Tammy know, Blanchard young, was a really, really young great young, like but you know, it. I thought, okay, well, nobody's going to look as much like her as Judy Davis did, but I was proved wrong.
Yeah. And I said, when I was watching the awards, just like, I always forget like how like squinty eyed Renee Zellweger
is. I said that in your stead. You always say that.
Yeah. But it's like, it's really weird because watching this movie, you would never think that that's how her like eyes naturally are, because the wide eyedness is all over the place here.
She's
had
a lot of work done.
Yes. Yeah.
So Renee, that Botox-y eye.
Yeah. Well, what do we think of everybody else in the cast too? Like,
there are other people in this movie.
Yeah, there are other people. Figure there. Well, you know, we had the great Michael Gambone as the hotel manager there.
Oh, the club manager.
The club manager.
Yeah.
The hotel. Oh, yeah. Both.
Yeah.
And then who played Sid Luft?
Rufus Sewell.
Rufus Sewell.
Was, Sid Luft. Yeah. Finn Wittrock was.
Mickey Deans.
Mickey Deans, her last husband. that guy.
but the only one of the supporting actors that really stood out to me was Jessie Buckley as her assistant.
Right. She had the most to do for sure.
Yeah. Everybody else just seemed to be kind of satellites or, you know,
in the background.
Even someone as renowned as Michael Gambon, to have him, you know, it was just kind of like a glorified cameo.
You know, for like 2 seconds, I just go,
here.
I know, I was just like, oh, wait, hey, Dumbledore's in this. Yeah, he didn't really do, I mean, he had some angry faces when she wasn't showing up for her performances.
I feel like he exists for that one scene where she's going to apologize. And even then, there's not really much for him to do except scowl and stuff. But, you know, I didn't know that much about Mickey Deans at all. I'm sure that you guys did.
There's not a lot to know.
She was married to him for, like, what, 3 weeks or something?
Well, yeah, but, like, what did you think of his character in this? Because, like, you know, Whitrock, like, sort of plays him more as, like, an earnest failure, you know, as opposed to, like, somebody just trying to take advantage. Is what I kind of got of that. I always thought of him as maybe just like a, you know, a creeper, you know, trying to chase the fame person. Like, I don't know, what's the opposite of a...
Yeah, I know, but
what's
like
the fame version of a gold digger, I guess.
At this point, though, there was no dig... There was no gold dig.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, just a
the well
fame,
was dry.
Fame junkie, I guess.
Yeah,
but
I don't know.
I think toward the end of her life, she ran into a series of people who thought that they could save her and sort of make her...
She really wanted to be saved.
Yeah. And take care of her and bring her back to what she should be. And, of course, they all failed miserably. But...
Absolutely. And, you guys know a lot about the, stuff with Sid Luft and everything. What did you think of his portrayal in this? Because I see in Rufus Sewell, like, Rufus Sewell has always been one of my favorite actors.
He's always
like,
a douche.
He's always a jerk in every movie. And so I love it when he gets to play something that's not that.
But he kind of was.
But that's what I'm saying is, like, you know, like, I always saw Sid Luft, like, and again, maybe it's because I'm really colored by the Judy Davis.
Because you like Victor
because
Garber.
Because I really love Victor Garber. Who doesn't love Victor Garber? But, like,
there's a really good documentary, Sid and Judy, right now, that's on Stars.
Really? Mm-hmm. Ooh,
yep. Check that out. It's about the middle of her life and their marriage, and it's pretty good. So, if you want to know the truth,
I would love to know the truth. There, that's called a next step. There, audience. Yeah. What did you guys think of Rufus Sewell's portrayal here? Because this is a very complex relationship, and I loved the scenes that they had together in this movie.
I thought he did fine. I mean, it's very different from Garber's portrayal, and it's still when you watch documentaries or something like that. You know, Sid Luft was this sort of really tough, almost, you know, very very macho guy who hung out with Sinatra, and you know, and maybe had connections to the mob. We're not sure, but
he hung out with Sinatra.
Yeah, they always imply that he has mob connections. They always imply that.
But, not to reinforce the stereotype, but
I think Sewell's portrayal is kind of in between. Garber played it very sensitively, and
definitely played like her protector.
But it's also very like kind of long suffering saint type of thing. Yeah. And
Sewell played it toward. I mean, this is after their divorce, and you know, Sewell played it like he's kind of at the end of his rope with her.
Yeah,
that's kind of how I felt. Yeah. I mean, it was very contentious between the two of them.
Yeah, but he like never raises his voice to her.
No, but I mean,
you know, you're right. It's like he's just had it with her, but he's just still too wearied from all the fighting, like that he can't like even muster to like yell at
her. And
then,
you know,
he wants
the kids to stay with him. I mean, rightfully so. I mean, those poor kids.
Oh my God.
He just has a been there, done that kind of quality.
Yeah. I mean, he's not mean. Yeah. He's not.
Yeah. Cause she starts going into like her typical, you know, like, or I would assume typical thing, you know, like saying these statements and
she always kind of spun out,
flipping out a little. And like every time it happened in this movie, he just like doesn't even like change his face. He's just kind of like, I've seen this. It's not going to work.
He was her longest husband. And I mean, maybe 15 sort of years they were together. That's like 100 in Judy Garland world. Most of her husbands lasted like 6 months. he'd been through the mill with her.
He
was fine. I mean, like I said, nobody really gets a chance to do anything besides her, but he's fine. He's fine. Finn Wittrock is good. I like him. Yeah. He's an interesting actor. So he does well with it. I mean, I guess I kind of forgot about him trying to bring her back and open these clubs and things for her. And, you know, I in my head, I was like, really actually ever a thing? Or was he just like, spinning?
I thought that it was literally going to be like, you know, this is just total BS. Like, he doesn't have connections or anything. But, like, the movie kind of portrays it as, like, he tried, but it just kind of didn't
work. I think he thinks he can make it happen, but I think most people that came in contact her at that point in her life didn't know how far she had dug herself into a hole.
Right. Like, everybody thinks, oh, I can build off the Judy Garland name, but, you know, there's not much left to the name at this point.
Yeah. A lot of debt and negativity at this point.
Yeah. It's just a little.
Yeah, I also think how it's interesting that they had to squeeze in a scene with Liza at the beginning just so you could get that
because, you know.
We just had to make sure everyone knew that Liza was her daughter and that they were.
Yeah. Didn't she love that too? That he's just like, you're not nervous and stuff? Like, I just thought that was really such a charming little conversation.
She's just like, I don't know. That's so far gone that she has nowhere to go but to like a swinging party with Liza and yeah. I don't know. It's just kind of like, Oh geez.
Hooking up with a young Mickey Beans here. That scene too, also like what follows there when she's hanging out with Mickey and stuff. Like I said, there's moments in this movie that I love that show you that even in as broken a state as Judy is at this point in her life, that just natural, I guess, just glow about her that can like make people happy is still there, you know? And that's kind of one of those scenes when she's just goofing off with Mickey and, you know, when she's kind of schmoozing the party, but especially the scenes, I think, with the couple in London. And those are some of my favorite scenes. And I love the way that unfolded because, you know, it's just general hanging out, you know, and just like, I do love though, she's just like, oh, well, you know, can I come and have dinner with you? And
they're just taking her back. I think my favorite part is like the typical like gay trope of like pictures of Barbara and Judy. They literally had like framed pictures of her like all I was like okay
well, probably the stereotype a bit there
but it was a really nice moment.
Lead to you know, because I think at the very end of that whole sequence, you know, he's playing Somewhere Over the Rainbow for or is it something
Get Happy
it's a slow version of Get Happy. And it turns into like this really emotional thing for him where then we start to see all the Judy stuff that he has on his wall and how Judy hasn't just been someone he's liked to listen to for his life, but she's kind of been like a support for him.
And her advocacy of you know, the LGBT community,
right?
So I mean that was a huge deal for them. I mean, he talks about their relationship and how it's not
right,
you know. So imagine like just like going out one night and like running into like, I don't know, Bono and being like, oh hey,
and he's like, hey, can I come over to your place?
I mean, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, that's like,
we'll make some eggs,
you know. Yeah, like
that was like a surreal moment, but again, it's just like Judy can connect with anyone, you know. Is that, what did you think of these scenes, Brandon?
Well, yeah, and that was that's really kind of what I think what they're trying to get at is, you know, at some point everybody sort of turned their back on her except the audience. That was
right.
The one
she always had him right here.
That was her one go-to, you know. And
very good point.
And of course, when you, I mean, we'll talk about it, but when you get to the scene where the audience turns on her, that's kind of the lowest point. And,
right.
And that's really the thing that she couldn't come back from.
Yeah.
But those scenes are great because she's just, she was such a down to earth, witty individual that, you know, she was able, as you said, to just connect with anybody and whether on a stage or just in life.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, those, like that, again, like that's what I love about those particular scenes, you know, with that couple. But you're right, I think the crux of the movie, the reason why the movie is as good as it is besides Zellweger are those concert scenes. And we get a lot of them, you know, and there's a lot of triumph that happens in those, especially with the very first one that she does. There's a lot of heartbreak that happens in those concerts. You know, especially, you're right, the one where the audience does turn on her. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, like, both of you about this, if you knew, was, you know, like, is that something that did happen? Like, did the audience just naturally turn on her, or was it because, you know, she was constantly late for these shows because of the pills and stuff like that? Like, how much truth do we get in this scenes where the audience is turning on her?
That incident where people were throwing dinner rolls at her did happen.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, that was when
I would have pegged that definitely for dramatic license.
I'm trying to think what, I think it was like on CBS Sunday Morning or something like that. They did a profile on this movie when it came out and they showed a newspaper clipping of that. And, you know, the reporter actually said people were throwing food at her.
Jeez.
But yeah, there were I think there were a couple of instances in later life where, you know, audiences would boo and walk out when she would, you know, come in, you know, half hour late and then not be up to snuff once she was there.
Right. Well, Sarah, what did you think of all of these concert scenes that we got? Because, you know, as we said, there's such high highs and such low lows, but like they're kind of a big reason why this movie is as good as it is, aside from Zellweger's performance.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this movie, besides, I mean, it's like mainly a series of concerts that we're just watching of her. And I mean, it is kind of jarring because you think of her as just like this beloved icon, and you can't imagine that people would actually like throw things at her and feel this way about her. But I mean, it just reached this point where, you know, people had paid to see her, and mm-hmm. she couldn't commit. She just could not. I think a lot of it, I mean, was just mental. She couldn't get herself up to the point where she was ready to do it. I mean, and she, like Jeremy said earlier, she didn't know if she had it in her to do it, to get out there and do it. And I think people just got tired of it. I mean, I think most of her audiences still wanted to believe that, you know, okay, we've booked this concert series, we've paid for tickets, it's going to happen. Yeah. But the fact that she would, you know, pull these shenanigans so often caused people to just kind of get, you know, downhearted about it. Mm-hmm. So
I did love the whole sequence of her opening night where she's not showing up, and, you know, the assistant
in the bathroom,
the assistant drives all the way to the hotel to get her, and they
dress her and put her lipstick on her. Yeah.
I mean, you can imagine how exhausting it was for those people.
That's the truth of it though. I mean, she needed to have someone that was constantly basically babysitting her mm-hmm. and making sure she got to where she needed to be all the time, because without that, I mean, you never knew if that was going to happen or not.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be, as that assistant, I mean, that's your whole job, is to make sure these acts come through, and just like this famous woman is just not showing up, and you have to basically, you know, break down the bathroom door and be like, all right, put your clothes on, let's go. I mean, I know, I just remember like when she kind of just, so was like, okay, and she just kind of pushed her out on stage, and it was just like, oh God, I mean, hang on to your butts. Let's hope this happens. You know? So that's terrifying.
Like, it's like the band leader who, once he sees her backstage, he's like, okay guys, here we go.
Yeah. I'm not really sure what she's, and I was thinking about like that rehearsal, that not rehearsal that they had. She walks in and he's like, okay, we're going to run it. And she's basically just like, no, I'm fine.
He basically gives her the block, and that's pretty much it of where the audience is going to be.
How many levels are there? And then she's like, all right, just picks up her stuff. This poor guy's just like, what? I mean, I feel like as the band leader, he probably had no clue what the hell she was going to do.
Right. You know, between
that and the second season of Mrs. Maisel, like, I'm sitting there thinking, like, man, being a band leader for anybody in this time period in history would have been terrible. You just never know what you're going to play at any given moment.
Can you imagine, like, just being, like, just go, I mean, it's like those nightmares you have, us as performers, you know, those nightmares you have of opening night and you don't know your lines.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, like, that's what it feels like every time they put her out on stage, like, that she's just shell-shocked for the first 5 minutes, and then it's just kind of like, it just, you know, starts to roll in her head and she goes for it. But every time she walks out on stage, I was just like, oh god, do something,
do well please.
Yeah.
And I really love, I think my favorite was the last time that she went out there, obviously at the end, when that the guitarist that was in singer that was kind of replacing her, and he let her go out and do that last song, and it was just, that was really kind of heartwarming for, I mean, for him, it was probably, just, I mean, he probably had it. You probably call him, he's not coming tonight, you got to fill it. And then she shows up and he's back there in his tux. He's like, what the hell, lady?
And can you imagine being, you know, this little unknown performer having to go out and replace Judy Garland in front of a house that paid to see Judy Garland?
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Let's start the justice for Lonnie Donegan. Okay?
Lonnie Donegan. I know. I remember I kept saying I thought it was reverse. I was like, I thought it should be Donnie Lonnegan.
Let's start the justice for Lonnie here.
No, really, guy. I felt that guy got called up. It was like getting called up from the minors like a bunch of times, and then he just kept getting sent back down.
Yeah.
And then finally it's his turn and she shows up and he's like, what now, lady? And then it's like, okay. You know?
That's our interpretation of the last scene.
That's how I feel about it.
And I want to save that for our very last discussion of that last concert there. But let's get to what I want to talk about here, Brandon.
Yeah.
Because, man,
what's that?
I love the history of Hollywood, but Louis B. Mayer can just go straight to hell. I'm sorry, but it's like, and I have to assume this is played up quite a bit. You know, like there's quite a bit of colorful language happening here. Yeah. I don't know how accurate. Well, who would even know? You know,
I mean, they're jamming years of years of abuse into two scenes, you know.
I mean, she was at MGM for half her life, you know, 15 years.
Right.
So it was a complex relationship, you know, and you read reports of, you know, during the final years when she had all those breakdowns and had to have those hospital stays, you know, Louis B. Mayer personally paid out of his pocket for all of her hospital stays.
Right. So that's the thing I want to get out there is just like, so here's the thing, okay? Louis B. Mayer did do good things for Judy, all right? Mm-hmm. He did. You're right. Stuff like that. He did see, you know, he did kind of, especially at the beginning with Wizard of Oz, you said, like, kind of care for her as kind of a father figure. But
oh, I mean, he thought of her talent immensely. I mean, yes. She came in with that voice, and he was extremely protective of her as his, I mean, I guess
his
property
yeah.
a little bit.
Well,
too,
and
he wasn't just a, like, a yeah. dirty tyrant.
Yeah, well, I think he's the one who was, you know, no, we're not going to use Shirley Temple. Let's use Judy.
Right, we're going to use this. Right. Yeah.
If I remember right, he was the one, that fought against the Shirley Temple of Wizard of Oz. So it's a very weird thing here. So, like, Brandon, you can speak to this way better than I can, but, mm-hmm. like, how much of this is fluff, all right? Because obviously we're condensing things. We're doing some of this stuff. You know, Mayer wasn't a saint, even when, you know, all of his interactions with Garland. But how accurate, what grade of accuracy are we going to give to the way they treat him in these flashbacks?
I would say like a B or a B minus maybe.
Okay.
Mickey Rooney, who was never the greatest source either because he changed his stories throughout his
right,
life.
Exactly.
But apparently, you know, I think the scene with them doing the photo shoot in the little diner.
Yes.
I think there was some dramatic license taken there, but you know, there was always stories about how, you know, that they really controlled your diet whenever you would go and have lunch. And apparently, like, there was a period where only Judy could have chicken soup for lunch every day because they wanted to keep her weight down.
That's very accurate.
That was accurate. I think the real monster, and they never say it is, but her mother.
Oh, yeah.
I would assume that's her mother.
It had to have been her mother because her mother was the first person to ever give her the pills.
Her mother was terrible.
Her mother was,
I mean, you talk about stage mom.
Yeah.
Jeez.
She was the biggest enabler of them all, I think. But
her mom shattered her confidence.
Because Mayer's whole thing comes from basically Mayer was
I have a studio to run and it's
yeah. Well, that one is definitely the harshest. But like even the very beginning of this movie, seeing, you know, him, you know, talk about, oh, maybe Shirley Temple, you know, like even that's not quite played up exactly how I remember my Hollywood history with Louis
right.
B. Mayer. But like the scene, obviously the shed scene after she jumps in the pool and stuff. This is the one that everybody goes in on because Brandon, you're right. Like you're right. And when you pointed this out to me, it's just like the movie definitely makes it seem like there is something, let's just say, pedophilic going on in Mayer's mind here in this scene. And I really don't remember hearing anything like that with Louis B. Mayer. Am I right in that remembering?
Right. I think the one that seems to be the most accurate is that opening scene where he's really downplaying her looks. Now that surely happened because, you know, MGM was the glamour studio. And so she was always next to people like Lana Turner and Hedy Lamarr. And so they always loved to let her know that she was the homely one of the group.
She was the ugly one.
Yeah.
She was the one, she had the voice, but not the looks.
She had the voice. And like, it's that little bit of dialogue at the beginning, like, but you have that amazing voice that those pretty girls don't have.
Right.
Yeah.
Thin pretty girls. Yeah. I think he said thin a couple times.
You just want to punch him that entire opening.
Yeah.
I mean, that was
pretty
accurate.
It really does, like, you know, speak to the ultimate tragedy for life. It's just, you just think about, like, if she would have been given one ally, you know, in those early days, you know, one real fight for her, stand up to these people ally, like,
I think
maybe we give something, a different end to her story.
Like, what I said about that scene you're talking about, the pedophilia scene, was she had a lot of problems with, obviously, it stemmed from people telling her that she was ugly most of her life, but she dated a lot of men.
Yes.
She had a lot of affairs. She dated a lot of high-profile men.
She married
a lot of men. She had a lot of men, you know, after her. And so I kind of took that scene with him as kind of a combination of all the men in her life, the way that they treated her.
Yeah.
That's the way I kind of just saw it, like, projected just through him, because they weren't doing flashbacks. through every man in her life. But I thought, I just kind of took that as like all the men in her life that kind of objectified her.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I went.
That raises a good question. Brandon, what did you think? Like, are we seeing these flashbacks as Judy's memories as she's remembering them, or are they specifically for us for context?
You know, and that's part of the issue I have with this movie. They don't make that clear.
Right.
but I think to me, it's more like it's the way that she sees the past. It's sort
of, that's,
you know, because that's where Sarah's explanation there makes a lot of sense.
Well, that's what I thought, because I thought they always came at moment. They always came in kind of reflective moments for her.
Right.
So when something would happen in her present life, I felt like then she would think back to, okay, this happened in my past, so this is why I'm doing this now.
Right.
That's kind of how I looked at it. I don't think it was either. I don't think it was clear cut either. Like, oh, she's now as she's eating her bite of dinner, she remembers this moment, you know. Or I also don't think it was just a
zoom in on the bite.
I think it was like more of a, I don't know, like a
and that's more, you know, like I wish we had just gotten a balance of the good and the bad, just so you could put things.
So
in context,
just go watch Me and My Shadows.
Because of those triumphs.
Because I got a book for Christmas about the history of movie musicals or whatever, and there's a section about her in it, and they had a quote from Gene Kelly who said, like, you know, ever since her death, people always tried to talk to me about, you know, all the bad things she went through and everything. He said, she and I just always had fun together. I only had good memories, so I don't know, you know, it's hard to always talk about the tragedies when that's what people want you to talk about all the time. But,
well, that's as good a segue as you can get into the final scene of this movie, because it is a very triumphant ending of this.
Yeah.
You know, she's once again gotten herself kicked out of another concert place, you know, and, you know, people have been fed up with her, and she begs for one more shot, and man, she makes it count, you know. I mean, like, it's like really, really crazy there. But, you know, there's just this triumph of singing that song. And like, that's really where I think you see, even more than that first concert there, that's where you really get to see that energy that Judy had on stage in the first number. I can't remember exactly what number that was, but like the big upbeat one that she did before.
Oh, yeah, what does she do?
Before Rainbow. I can't remember it, but.
She does the trolley song earlier.
What is she?
I don't know if it was one of hers, but I think it was like one of those standard songs.
It is
the time,
a standard. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah.
Either way, it was really great, guys. Remember that song? That was great. but then, you know, obviously we get into the Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and it's smart of the filmmakers to save it for this moment. You know, they tease it at that rehearsal.
Yeah, I wondered if they'd even do it. Period. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? She didn't. She really did not perform it that much. She only did it a handful of times after in her
In real life, saying?
Yeah, yeah. She didn't. She really didn't perform it that much.
That's interesting to me. Huh. Well, I mean, I guess if you sing it enough times. But like, Brandon, what did you think of this final scene and how this film wrapped up specifically?
I thought it was a very good ending, you know, after all of the... after all of the sadness that we'd witnessed, to be able to, you know, see that little bit of, because I kept thinking to myself, how are they going to end this? Because
it just kind of floats there, you know. It's not it's not, you know, a story that has peaks and valleys, and then it has a natural ending. It's just kind of like, so wait, she's going to get. I wondered if they were going to go through her death.
Yeah, I kept thinking, I don't, by the time we got to that point, I'm like, I don't think we're going to see her die. I think we're going to get to the ending somehow. And then once, you know, once she got out on stage and everything, I thought, okay, we're going to see like one final performance here. I wasn't sure if it's going to be Over the Rainbow or not.
And yeah. Once she said, you know, when she asked if she could do one more, then I looked at Jeremy and I was like, okay, yeah. She's going to do Over the Rainbow.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, I mean, it was a very fitting end. Yeah. I kept thinking, cause I mean, up to that point, the point that we finished at was only like a couple months before her death.
Mm-hmm. I think the ending said like she died 6 months later or something
six months.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're pretty close to it, but yeah, I just feel like if they would have ended on that, it would have just been like a real downer.
Yeah.
So I thought that of all this, obviously, that had to be the one that they ended on if they were going to just go out on a concert.
Yeah.
But yeah, the fact that she got so emotional doing it, and I mean, I just love those little guys just stood up and
started singing. her friends from the apartment.
Well, but the only thing that annoyed me about that, sorry, is that I wanted them to just like jump in where she stopped and finish it. But right. They like went all the way back to the beginning, and I was just like,
okay.
sorry, I know, but you know, like yeah. that's like an example. Like when I was like, I was singing the national anthem at a state basketball game one time, and I literally just blanked on the words.
Really,
like three quarters of the way through, and my sweet little mom stood up in the stands and started going, "And the Rockets, right?" I mean, that you know, go. And they're like helping you to get back on.
It's a Monty Williams moment.
That was when I was just. That's like, yeah, okay, I guess it is the musician in me, but I was like, why did you start over? She did that part right.
Well, and I mean, like the moment of this film is, you know, when she says, you know, "Don't forget about me."
Yeah.
Like, you won't forget me, will you? Like,
promise.
Yeah.
She says promise too, doesn't she?
I think so.
And it's, man, that's a powerful ending, especially the way Zellweger plays it, because there is just that, like, man, she's conveying joy and desperation and, you know, intense longing all in one little look.
It's massive foreshadowing too.
Right.
I mean, it's like, it's right there. We're at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, this lady, she's only what, 40, 45, 46.
Yeah. That's,
I mean, yeah, but yeah, it's a pretty, that last moment. You're just, I definitely had tears in my eyes at that.
Yeah, I did too. What about you, Brandon?
Oh, I mean, from the minute she breaks down, you know, mm-hmm. Zellweger just has you in the palm of her hand in that scene. Yeah. And you just, you know, it's kind of like, you know, in that little split second, you know, she made you feel her entire history in that one moment. Like, you know, everything, you know, that has happened to me has come to this point. And, and then, you know, once again, the audience, the people who always have her back are the one that saves her. So,
exactly. You're right. That connection with the audience is what ultimately saves her. Obviously, you know, we've talked for a little while here about the movie, but this is an Oscar spotlight. We have two nominations for Judy, obviously Best Actress for Renee Zellweger, and then Best Makeup and Hairstyling, actually, which makes sense. They do a great job transforming her in there. That one is going up against Bombshell, Joker, Maleficent, The Mistress of Evil, and 1917. So, honestly,
I don't, movies always win.
Well, yeah,
the special war movies.
And I honestly don't know about this category. It's going to be pretty interesting one to try and break down.
I watched Bombshell a few days ago, and it's, I mean, Charlize Theron is eerily, you know, Megyn Kelly clone.
That might be the Bombshell award, might it? You know, it's weird because typically you would go with something like a Maleficent, you know, like with crazy, crazy makeup. But it seems like, you know, with that 1917, Joker, and Bombshell, it's in Judy, it's like, you know, they're going for the more
realistic. How do you make someone look like a real?
So in that sense, if that's the way the Academy is kind of leaning this year with four of those five nominees, sure, I could see Judy taking it. They do a great job transforming her into Judy Garland.
Mm-hmm. Yep, she looks just like her. It's creepy.
Yeah, I think I read where originally what they did was they put the whole like Judy drag on her, and then little by little took it off until they said, okay, how much natural Renee can we have in here with
can
Judy?
We keep, so there's a little left.
So
And then obviously the big award, that Best Actress.
Yeah, and this is the one obviously everyone's the most confident in because, well, she hasn't lost yet. in the award season. And I believe this was a part BBC film as well. So, you know, obviously the BAFTA's looking good. But they like to award their own films.
Who's she up against?
Yeah, so she's up against Scarlett Johansson for Marriage Story. Saoirse Ronan for Little Women, which again, just whenever she does a movie, just give her a nomination. Mm-hmm. Apparently that's how it goes. Charlize Theron for Bombshell, and then Cynthia Erivo for Harriet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Honestly, you know, as many great performances as there have been from all of these women, it's kind of hard to see how she's going to be stopped at this point. I mean, you guys have any other leanings on that?
She seems to be pretty much a lock, I think, because unless, you know, Glenn Close upset happens this year and we have.
Yeah, but even that, we had a few awards that were giving us some, you know, like Colby took a couple of SAGs and I think they split the BAFTA. So, I mean, you know, like, you know, there were some indications, but Yeah, but I think that this is probably going to be Oscar number two for Zellweger. Is that what you're getting, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen only two of those other performances. I've seen Ronan and ScarJo, and I mean, they're both good performances.
Both great, yeah.
But this, it's just so much more. It's just so much more in depth, I feel like, than the other two. So I don't think you're going to have a big surprise this year on that.
Probably not with the acting categories. But Brandon, you said that it was really cool that like you thought maybe you and I both thought maybe earlier in the season that, you know, the Academy wouldn't want to award two musical bio performances.
Hey, it's not her fault that movie came out last year.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
I mean, it is weird. You're right. But.
Well, and I said this when I did the Jojo Rabbit spotlight a couple days ago. I said, really, I think the reason why the acting categories are such locks this year is I think they're all determined to award these people who've been overlooked for good performances in previous years. So that's why you're going to see Brad Pitt, Joaquin, and Laura Dern get it. And even though Renee's won before, I think this is a sort of a symbolic gesture in honoring Judy when they didn't do it while she was alive. So
that's actually a very good point. There could be some Judy Garland ghosting.
Did she get like a mini Oscar
there
for Wizard of Oz?
Yeah.
It wasn't competitive.
Famously.
Not real, right?
Famously got screwed out of her Oscar for A Star Is Born. Yeah.
In My Shadows, she's in the bed in the hospital and ready to film her wedding.
And Renee Zellweger, even in her SAG acceptance speech, said, you know, I know this is more, you know, in tribute to Judy, letting her know that her community hasn't forgotten her and things like that. So
that's really, really great. Well, hopefully she brings that to her Oscar win. Just super good call it now. All right, that's going to do it for this Oscar spotlight, everyone. We hope that you've enjoyed it. Of course, let us know what you thought of Judy. Find us on the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter, and of course, frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. So many more Oscar spotlights to go, not just the movie ones, but we will be breaking down the top eight categories the week leading up to the ceremony. Every single day you'll get a new episode. And of course, the Front Row is once again hosting our Oscar party at the Hoagland Center for the Arts. If you want to come party it up with us, win some prizes, and just hang out with the coolest people there is in the podcasting world, go to hcfta.org to get your tickets. They are going fast. Do not wait. They're going to be gone before you know it. All right. Anything else from anybody here? Sarah?
Nope.
Brandon?
I don't think so.
All right. That's what we love. Short, sweet, easy to remember. All right. For the Front Row Network and Judy, I am Jeremy Gechner.
I'm Sarah Baltusevich Gechner.
I'm Brandon Davis.
And as Gechner. Always, we'll see you in the Front Row. It made it sound like Brandon was Gechner.
I know. That's why I said that. All the Gechners.
All the Gechners. We're just going to see you in the Front Row. Bye.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org.